time is now 6 p.m. Welcome to WORT's local news for Wednesday, April the 9th, 2025. I'm your host, Robert McClure.
And I'm your host, Vicki Iden. In tonight's news, statewide and local food programs navigate federal funding cuts.
The state Supreme Court has some high-profile cases on its docket.
And in the second half, we'll learn about an immigrant rights group on the UW-Madison campus, revisit some headlines from 61 years ago, and broadcast the most comprehensive weather report on the airwaves.
So stay tuned, all those stories and more coming up, but first we'll go live to London for a bulletin of world news from the BBC.
This is Danielle Yao of Yetzka with the BBC News. Hello. In a dramatic change of policy, Donald Trump has paused higher tariffs on goods entering the United States from most countries, excepting China. The president said levies would be lowered on many countries, but taxes on Chinese imports would rise. John Sudworth has the details.
After days of turmoil, President Trump pulled back from his global trade war in a very Trumpian way, a post on social media. He was pausing his raft of punitive tariffs for 90 days, he said, to allow negotiations on better trade deals to take place. The announcement still leaves a baseline 10% tariff in place on all US imports, and one country was not spared at all. Mr. Trump upped the tariff on Chinese goods to 125%, effective immediately, because, he said, China's decision to put its own retaliatory tariffs in place had shown a lack of respect.
The World Trade Organization is forecasting that the trade of goods between the US and China could fall by 80% because of their deteriorating relationship. That would amount to a loss of more than $400 billion in trade. Jonathan Josephs reports.
The World Trade Organization is warning that President Trump's sweeping tariffs on China and its retaliation risk bringing a huge shock to the global economy, with poorer countries suffering the most. Based on last year's trade figures, an 80% reduction would mean a $466 billion drop in trade, with fewer soybeans, pharmaceuticals, electronics and toys being sold across the Pacific. The head of the WTO warned of tariffs causing a long-term divide and urged countries to work together to protect a rules-based system of global trade.
The United States has imposed fresh sanctions on Iran, days after President Trump announced he was planning direct talks with Tehran over its nuclear program. The measures target five entities and one individual connected to Iran's Atomic Energy Organization. The move seems designed to increase pressure on Tehran before Saturday's talks in Oman. On Wednesday, Mr. Trump repeated his threat that military force was possible if Tehran didn't end its nuclear program. He also said Israel would play a key role. Rescue workers in the Dominican Republic are continuing to search for survivors almost 2 days after the roof of a music venue collapsed during a concert. 124 bodies have already been pulled out from the ruins of the Jet Set Club. The emergency services say they believe there are another 20 people under the rubble. Some of the trapped victims' relatives are waiting for updates outside. Among them is Shailin Pena, whose father, stepmother and aunt are still under the rubble.
I want to go in there, you know, get rid of all the rocks. As much as I want to, I can't. So I really just have to, like, sit it out and wait.
You're listening to the latest world news from the BBC. The US Senate has confirmed the evangelical Christian Mike Huckabee as Washington's ambassador to Israel. Mr. Huckabee, an outspoken supporter of Israel, has long backed calls for the annexation of the occupied West Bank. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has expanded Jewish settlements in the West Bank, but has so far stopped short of formal annexation. A former senior Facebook executive has said its parent company, Meta, undermined national security and betrayed American values in order to build an $18 billion business in China. Appearing in front of a Senate Judiciary Subcommittee hearing, Sarah Wynne Williams alleged that the owner of Facebook and Instagram worked hand in glove with Beijing on potential ways of allowing censorship in China. Scientists mapping a tiny part of a mouse's brain have found it to be so complex it resembles a galaxy. The study first identified the neurons in a 1 cubic millimetre section of the brain, about the size of a grain of sand. Researchers then traced how those nerve cells sent messages to each other through the network of hundreds of millions of synapses that connect them. One of the study's authors, Forrest Coleman, says the discovery can help scientists learn more about how brains work.
Neuroscientists' best idea about how do our brains function is that information flows through these complex networks and is processed through the really complicated, intricate patterns that these neurons are making with one another in these synaptic connections. And so having a map of that is a kind of foundational resource to try to understand how the brain is doing that. How does it do everything that it does that, you know, is an integral part of our everyday experience?
In football, Barcelona have comprehensively beaten Borussia Dortmund 4-0 in their European Champions League quarterfinal first leg. In Wednesday's other game, Paris Saint-Germain came from behind in the French capital to beat Aston Villa 3-1. BBC News.
Good evening, this is Rob McClure and Vicki Iden bringing you your local news live from the WORT studios on Bedford Street in downtown Madison. Here are tonight's headlines.
Riding the high from last week's victory in the state Supreme Court, National Democrats are targeting two Wisconsin congressional seats to flip in 2026, reports the Wisconsin State Journal. In a statement yesterday, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, a.k.a. the DCCC, listed Wisconsin's 1st and 3rd congressional districts as key seats to secure a majority in the U.S. House of Representatives. Those seats are currently filled by Republicans Brian Steil and Derek Van Orden. Democrats also targeted Reps and Van Orden in the November election. Rep Steil and Van Orden in the November election, but both retained their seats with comfortable margins. Still, National Democrats are gaining confidence after Susan Crawford's win last week.
Wisconsin has joined other states in filing dozens of lawsuits against the Trump administration. And in response, the GOP is pushing to limit state courts' power over federal policy. More than 100 lawsuits have been filed against the administration in the weeks since Donald Trump's return to the Oval Office. State Attorney General Josh Call has added Wisconsin's support to lawsuits brought by other states for issues including birthright citizenship, the dismissal of federal workers, the cancellation of research and medical grants, and who can access personal data. Meanwhile, House Republicans have introduced a new bill that would limit district court judges' power to block presidential policies, including executive orders. Wisconsin's Republican Senator Ron Johnson and several Republican representatives are in support of that legislation, reports Wisconsin Public Radio. Wisconsin Representative Scott Fitzgerald wrote on social media yesterday that voters elected Donald Trump with a mandate and, quote, activist judges shouldn't be able to block his agenda with nationwide injunctions, end quote. House Republicans are expected to move the bill out of the House Rules Committee later this week.
The former warden of Waupun Correctional Institution has agreed to plead to a felony misconduct charge, reports WTMJ Milwaukee. Waupun is Wisconsin's oldest prison. It's been open since 1851. Recently, it's gained notoriety due to its poor living conditions, a months-long lockdown, an alleged smuggling ring involving prison employees, and six inmate deaths in the last 2 years. Former warden Randall Hepp and eight other former prison employees were arrested and charged this summer in connection with two of those deaths. One, Cameron Williams, who died of a stroke in October 2023. It took over 12 hours for correctional officers to notice. And another, Donald Meyer, who died in February of 2024 of apparent malnutrition and dehydration. According to Dodge County investigators, prison staff failed to feed Meyer 9 out of 12 meals over a 4-day period, shut off water to his cell, and didn't give him his medication for more than a week leading up to his death. Hepp initially pleaded not guilty in August. His sentencing is scheduled for the end of this month. One of the other former employees charged this summer, Jeremy Chalker, has had his charges dismissed at the start of the month.
A Canadian mining company was cleared yesterday to drill for gold and copper in northern Wisconsin. Green Light Metals was, yes, given the green light to start drilling in Taylor County, perhaps as early as this summer, reports Wisconsin Public Radio. Green Light has received both state and federal approvals to begin exploratory drilling in the Bend deposit, as it's called, which is believed to hold millions of tons of copper and gold. Pardon me. Their activity will be monitored by the state's Department of Natural Resources and the National Forest Service. The announcement came just days before the company goes public this coming Monday on the Toronto Stock Exchange. The company expects at least 5 years of exploratory drilling before determining if a mine can be profitably developed under Wisconsin law, and an additional 4 years after that for the project to migrate through the state's permitting process. The deal comes a month after Donald Trump invoked the Defense Production Act to boost domestic mineral production, and at a time when demand for minerals critical for building solar panels has increased due to green energy initiatives. Metals such as gold and copper haven't been mined in Wisconsin since the Flambeau mine was shut down in 1997.
Alliant Energy and Madison Gas and Electric each filed requests with the state regulators for rate increases over the next 2 years. Citing the cost of infrastructure improvements and grid maintenance, as well as rising transmission costs, both utilities seek to increase rates to as much as 5.7% for electricity and 4.1% for gas. Included in the infrastructure improvements are a number of solar power and battery storage stations, which are expected to reduce operating costs in the future.
Nurses at Meritor Hospital say they're prepared to go on strike to secure their demands as the union continues contract negotiations with the hospital. Service Employees International Union Wisconsin represents about 800 Meritor nurses who have been working without a contract since their last one expired on March 23rd. Among their top demands, enshrining Meritor's safety plans and guaranteed staffing ratios in the next labor agreement. Union nurses held an informational rally yesterday in Brigham Park in an effort to drum up public support. No formal strike notice has been issued, reports the Wisconsin Examiner. A bargaining session between the union and the hospital was scheduled for today. And those were the day's headlines. Now on to the rest of the day's top stories. Wisconsin schools are being forced to cancel contracts with local farms. After the U.S. Department of Agriculture axed more than $1 billion in funds promised to schools, childcare facilities, and food banks for local food partnerships. Judith Ruiz Branch of the Wisconsin News Connection has more.
Schools across Wisconsin are grappling with how to make up more than $16 million earmarked for healthier school meals, money that's part of the massive federal budget cuts the Trump administration says will curb government waste. The U.S. Department of Agriculture announced more than $1 billion in funding last year for two programs that help schools, childcare centers, and food banks buy locally sourced food. Caitlin Taurinens heads the School Nutrition Association of Wisconsin. She says schools have roughly $2 per child to spend on student lunches, and the federal funds helped bridge the gap in their slim budget and partner with local producers.
It's hard for us to do that with the budget that we have. And not only is it hurting the students and the schools that are consuming this food, but it's really making a huge impact on our farmers.
Schools and facilities had to cancel these local partnerships when the Trump administration cut these programs last month because, in its words, they no longer accomplished the goals of the agency. These cuts come as Congress is considering slashing safety net programs and requiring kids who receive free or reduced price lunch to provide proof of need. That could affect nearly 700 Wisconsin schools and more than 320,000 students. Stacy Nelson, who directs food nutrition services for the Menominee School District, says there would be vast implications if these changes take place.
I know everyone's been hungry and having to sit through something. It's really hard to retain any information or to participate and have a good attitude about things if all you can think about is that you're hungry and you're not sure where that next meal is going to come.
Nelson adds the federal dollars helped her district move away from using foods from big box corporations to provide healthier local options for kids, which has been shown to improve behavioral and learning habits.
Continuing to pull programs that are meant as a support to those kids isn't going to make America healthy again, which is what we keep saying we're trying to do.
Wisconsin U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin is among those demanding the USDA restore the programs. For Wisconsin News Connection, I'm Judith Ruiz Branch. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org. This story was produced with original reporting from John Israel for the Wisconsin Independent.
Meanwhile, two nonprofits closer to home are also struggling to navigate federal funding cuts, putting farm-to-school programs in Dane County at risk. WORT reporter Dane Bulow has more.
Last month, the Department of Agriculture announced a $660 million cut to the local Food for Schools program. The federal funding supports getting locally grown food into schools in over 40 states, including Wisconsin, reports CBS News. The program also supports nutrition programs, school gardens, and farmers markets. Now, the organizations that rely on the funds have an uncertain future. Erica Krug is the farm-to-school director at Rooted, a Madison-based food nonprofit that helps community gardeners. It also supports a handful of school gardens in Madison, organizes field trips in urban agriculture, and works with the Madison School District on building a farm-to-school network. This work is particularly reliant on federal USDA funding.
I know some organizations have been kind of looking at the numbers. I would say, So I don't have like a percentage of how much of that work is reliant on federal funding, but especially our farm to school work is heavily reliant on federal funding. The project that I mentioned where we're working with local farmers and school districts, that is through a USDA grant that we currently do have called the Lake Michigan Innovation Hub Grant. We have what's called a SPARK grant. So that was a project so we received that funding last summer. And it continues through this summer. We were hoping to apply for the next round of that, which was supposed to be announced on February 14th, but as of now, it has it's frozen. So people are hopeful that those funds will be released and that we'll be able to apply for another round of that funding. But as of now, we don't know what's happening.
Krug says that the USDA Farm to School grants have been a consistent source of funding, but without federal support, what's next is a huge question mark. But it's not only schools and nonprofits that rely on farm-to-school programs, it's also farmers. Mike Gasper is the Nutrition Services Director for the School District of Holman in northwest Wisconsin.
Well, like I said, it gives them an outlet for their product, a sure outlet, money they can count on, money they know they're going to get, right? Especially if they sign contracts with schools.
Gasper says each dollar spent is turned over between 6 to 10 times in local economies. And with those federal grants, the turnover has benefited Holman's economy multiple times over. Allison Harris is the farm to school director at Reap Food Group, which for the past 2.5 decades has helped connect the community with local food producers. You might know it best through the Farm Fresh Atlas. And last year, it was starting work on a USDA-funded collaborative to create a food systems action plan. Harris tells WORT that with uncertain federal funding, they're looking closer to home for support. As lawmakers craft the state's next 2-year budget, REAP is calling on key lawmakers to help continue their work.
That was my ask when I went before the Joint Finance Committee last week, I work on Healthy School Meals for All, which is the movement for no-cost school meals, and just hearing from legislative leadership or publicly from legislative leadership that that's not necessarily a priority right now. Can we find a middle ground?
For WORT News, I'm Dane Bulow.
Susan.
The time is now 6:19 p.m., and you're listening to the live local news on WORT.
Susan Crawford and Brad Schimmel were positioned in this spring's election as ideological opposites grappling for control of the state Supreme Court. Out-of-state mega donors flooded the race with cash and our screens and mailboxes with endless advertisements. Got Supreme Court fatigue? This spring is just the beginning of a five-year run. Wisconsin is slated to hold a court election every year through 2029. And while last week's victor, Susan Crawford, doesn't join the court until August, justices will be plenty busy before then. Brina Gadar is a staff attorney at UW Law School's State Democracy Research Initiative. Sitting down today with WORT news producer Faye Parks, she outlined some high-profile cases already on the docket and major issues that may soon reach Wisconsin's highest court.
There are a number of cases that the Wisconsin Supreme Court has already heard in oral argument but has yet to decide. One of those is a major case on abortion in the state and whether an 1849 state law is enforceable today as a ban on abortion. So that's one of the big ones. There are also a few cases about separation of powers before the Wisconsin Supreme Court, including the governor's use of his partial veto and some questions about the powers of the Joint Committee on Finance.
Now, further down the line, as you wrote in an explainer last month, we can expect the court to consider major issues like expanding more on abortion rights, labor unions in Act 10, and then more broadly, voting rights in our state. If you could just start by explaining how they might further consider abortion after this case they're hearing now.
Yes. So this statutory case about the 1849 law will be resolved before Judge Crawford joins the court as a justice in August. But there are other cases that could come up. So along with that statutory case, there is a constitutional challenge arguing that if that statute is interpreted as prohibiting most abortions, then it violates the Wisconsin Constitution. That case might go away depending on how the court rules in the statutory case, but we could see other constitutional challenges to other Wisconsin laws around abortion down the road.
Now, of course, the latest challenge to the Union Busting Law Act 10 has been sent to the Court of Appeals for now, but there's a decent chance that further down the line, the state Supreme Court will consider it once again. Crawford previously worked as a private attorney in a case that happened more than 10 years ago. How do you expect the court, the new court rather, to handle this case should it come to the Supreme Court?
I think it will be a bit of a tricky one for the court, in part due to recusals. As you mentioned, Judge Crawford worked on a different case in a private capacity as an attorney in the past. That case did involve a different issue than the challenge that's being brought now, but there is sort of a question about recusal there. And then two justices have actually already decided on recusal. Justice Brian Hagedorn has already recused from the case because he was involved in drafting and defending Act 10 as chief legal counsel for Governor Walker. And then Justice Janet Protasiewicz has rejected calls for her recusal, which were based on her participation in Act 10 protests and signing a petition to recall Scott Walker and some statements she made during her campaign. And so I think this will be a bit of a complicated one. The court will be down at least one justice, possibly more than that. So that will definitely impact how things go on that case.
Now, voting rights is perhaps the broadest category that you touched on in your explainer. If you could sort of just walk us through the top lines of that, what we might expect to see moving forward.
Some of it's cases that are already pending in lower courts, and some of it's cases that haven't been brought yet and might never be brought. Cases that are already pending include some questions about absentee ballot requirements in particular, including the witness requirement for absentee voters, and then also a lawsuit about the accessibility of absentee voting for individuals with certain disabilities who cannot independently read or mark their ballots. Those cases will likely work their way to the Wisconsin Supreme Court. They're not there yet, but they are sort of already pending issues. And then there have also been concerns or questions raised during this campaign period over voter ID and the state's U.S. congressional map. Currently, there are no challenges to voter ID pending, and it seems actually somewhat unlikely that there will be a major challenge to the state's voter ID law, given that we now have enshrined voter ID in the Constitution with that amendment last week. And then the congressional maps, we also don't have a current challenge to those, but folks have criticized those as unfairly favoring Republicans, given that our congressional delegation has 6 Republicans and 2 Democrats, whereas the state is, you know, pretty split, pretty purple state between Democratic and Republican votes. There's some question of whether there would be a renewed challenge to those congressional maps, and that is something that would definitely make its way to the Wisconsin Supreme Court if that happened.
Now, this spring's race kicked off a five-year run. Wisconsin voters will hold a state Supreme Court election every year through 2029. And of course, the court has become increasingly polarized in recent years. This spring's election once again broke national spending records. Is there a chance, in your opinion, that the court might consider moving forward campaign finance laws, ways to remove that kind of big spending from what's meant to be a nonpartisan race?
Yeah, so the campaign finance reform question is a pretty layered and complex one, given the different federal law and state law involved in facilitating how campaign finance works for these elections. Under federal law, there are free speech protections for and First Amendment protections for certain types of expenditures. And so a lot of the spending that we're seeing from independent groups that aren't the campaigns themselves, a lot of that is really hard to touch with state regulations around campaign finance because it's largely protected under the First Amendment. Where the state could step in and make some changes is around how state campaign finance laws work. And this would be something that would have to go through the legislature and the governor and be passed via law. One thing in particular is we have a pretty big loophole for individuals contributing to campaigns. If you contribute to the campaign itself, there's a limit, I believe, of $20,000 on how much an individual can contribute directly to a campaign. But there's no limit on how much the state political parties, so the Democratic Party or the Republican Party of Wisconsin, can contribute to the campaigns. And so there's this very sort of clear workaround that everyone knows about where you can give an unlimited amount of money to the state political party that then can turn around and give that money directly to the campaign. So that is something where we could see reforms. I don't know that that's likely in the current legislature or not, but it is something that I've seen discussed. And then I've also seen discussion around whether we should move to a model of publicly financing campaigns. And that's a method where you can offer to campaigns the opportunity to opt into public financing, and by doing that, agreeing to forgo these other outside financing options.
As I mentioned just now, Wisconsin is at the beginning of a series of court elections. With that in mind, do you expect more public scrutiny of the court and the decisions they make moving forward?
I think going forward, we'll continue to see a lot of what we've seen in recent years, which is a lot of attention on the high-profile decisions that the Wisconsin Supreme Court is making. So things like voting rights cases, election litigation, abortion, and Act 10, and redistricting more broadly. I think we won't necessarily see any increased attention to the host of other cases that the court decides. There are plenty of other cases that they're deciding that often just don't get that much attention, and I think that won't necessarily change.
I'm curious, is there a case on the docket right now or one that you see down the pipeline that you feel isn't getting enough scrutiny that should get more attention?
Some of the cases, you know, don't get as much attention just for understandable reasons. They have to do with things like termination of parental rights or whether evidence was properly submitted in a criminal case or things like that, that, you know, the average person in Wisconsin might not be that impacted by that decision, or at least in their current day-to-day life might not see as much impact there. I think the cases that are getting a decent amount of attention, but I think the impact might not be as clear for a lot of people in the state, is a lot of the separation of powers cases. So in Evers v. Markline, which is a case that's already decided in part, the Wisconsin Supreme Court ruled that a legislative committee cannot veto the DNR's expenditures of funds that had already been appropriated to a grant program. And that case has potentially major implications for how the legislature and the governor work together going forward, how the legislature and the executive branch work together. And there are some other cases around that as well, like the partial veto case having to do with a 400-year extension of school funding, and another case that was just two cases that were just heard last week having to do with the attorney general's ability to reach settlement agreements in certain types of cases without approval from a legislative committee, and another case having to do with a legislative committee's power over funds that were earmarked for a literacy program. And so there's sort of been a number of these cases that really have to do with what power the legislature can give to a legislative committee, what power the legislature itself can wield, what power the executive branch can wield. And while those cases are sort of in the weeds procedurally, they have a really big impact on how our state government runs and ultimately what programs and money is getting distributed to the people.
I've been speaking with Brenna Gadar, a staff attorney at UW Law School's State Democracy Research Initiative.
And you're listening to Handcrafted Local News on WORT. Stay with us for the second half of the show. We'll learn about an immigrants' rights group in the UW-Madison campus. We'll travel back in time to 1964, and we were supposed to be wet today. I'll tell you why we stayed dry instead and also bring you the details of the upcoming weekend.
But now we'll take a quick break, and we'll be back in a flash.
BBC News with Danielle Jaworowiecka. President Donald Trump has dramatically adjusted his tariff policy, pausing higher tariffs on goods entering the United States from most countries except China. The president posted on social media that levies would be lowered to 10% on countries which hadn't retaliated against his earlier tariffs, but he said taxes on Chinese imports would rise to 125%. Financial markets have soared in response to Mr. Trump's announcement. On Wall Street, all three main indexes jumped by more than 6% after days of turmoil that have seen stocks tumble. The US Treasury Secretary insisted the change of policy was not influenced by the global falls. In other news, the United States has imposed fresh sanctions on Iran days after President Trump announced he was planning direct talks with Tehran over its nuclear program. Mr. Trump repeated his threat that military force was possible if Tehran didn't end its nuclear activities. Rescue workers in the Dominican Republic are continuing to search for survivors almost 2 days after the roof of a music venue collapsed during a concert. Emergency services said another 20 people could be under the rubble. Tanzania's main opposition party says its leader, Tundu Lissu, has been arrested by police after attending a rally. Rights campaigners have accused the government of President Samia Suluhu Hassan of targeting opponents ahead of October's elections. A former senior Facebook executive has said its parent company Meta betrayed American values in developing its business in China. Sarah Wynne Williams told a Senate committee that the owner of Facebook and Instagram worked with Beijing to allow censorship in China. In football, Barcelona have comprehensively beaten Borussia Dortmund 4-0 in their European Champions League quarter-final first leg. In Wednesday's other game, Paris Saint-Germain came from behind in the French capital to beat Aston Villa 3-1. BBC News.
The time is now 6:32, and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. I'm your host, Robert McClure, here with my co-host, Vicki Iden. Thanks for joining us.
In a sweeping move this week, the Trump administration revoked nearly 300 student visas across the country. Six students and seven alumni at UW-Madison were impacted, according to a statement on Monday from the university. The university was not involved in the visa terminations, the statement writes, and is offering information about legal resources. In this edition of Cardinal Call, host Ted Hingstrom sits down with Daily Cardinal College News editor Ella Hanley to get the rundown on a UW-Madison student immigration group that provides support during these times of uncertainty.
Hello and welcome to Cardinal Call, your biweekly dose of news from UW-Madison's own Daily Cardinal student newspaper. We are your hosts, Oliver Gerhars
and Ted Hingstrom.
Last week, the Daily Cardinal newspaper released its action project, titled Uncertain Horizons, Immigrants in Wisconsin. The project aims to put a spotlight on the issue of immigration in Wisconsin. Today, we're joined by college news editor Ella Hanley to discuss her contribution to the project. Student Immigration Organization offers stability in times of uncertainty through advocacy events. Welcome, Ella.
Thank you.
Why did you choose to focus on the Advocates for Immigration's Rights, or AIR, for the Action Project?
Well, I think the name in itself is a pretty good indicator of the relevance in terms of our Action Project, just because they are quite literally advocating for immigrant rights. And I think it's an important group to highlight, especially in these times of political uncertainty.
Can you give me some background on what AIR is? How did it begin?
So AIR began in 2020. There were law students at UW-Madison who identified a gap in student organizations that focused specifically on immigration law. And so it was initially composed of law students, but since the organization has expanded and is now mostly comprised of undergraduate students.
Walk me through a typical meeting. What do they typically discuss?
AIR meetings discuss current events relating to immigration rights, and they have food and facilitate open discussion about conversations that otherwise might be met with hostility in a public sphere.
What major events does AIR host?
So AIR hosts two large-scale events every semester. One example is Immigration Justice Week, which is actually occurring right now. That is an effort, a collaborative effort with other advocacy groups like Students for Justice in Palestine, and the week will feature many events such as guest speakers, workshops like a Know Your Rights workshop, and panels with experts. And the focus really is to incentivize education and awareness. They also recently collaborated with SJP for a walkout in support of Mahmoud Khalil, who is a Columbia University student and protest leader who was recently arrested in New York. And that was another instance in which AIR felt that activism was truly critical in shaping the conversation around immigration rights.
Have they seen an increase in participation in the past few months? What do you think is spurring that?
They have seen an increase in participation in recent months due to the Trump administration's immigration decisions recently. One AIR member actually told me that it is unfortunate that times of crises like these are where advocacy really materializes. They do find it very encouraging that students are stepping up, and there has been a significant increase in membership and incentive to collaborate with other organizations in order to really get the message out.
Can you tell me how advocacy groups such as AIR can be important in the buildup of social movements?
I think AIR is really crucial right now, and that was one of the reasons why I selected it to highlight, because one of the things that the group focuses on besides education and awareness is providing hope. And for a lot of students, I think times are really uncertain, and providing hope in these kind of circumstances is really important. And I think AIR does a good job of executing that.
Do you think AIR is effective at what it's trying to accomplish? Did your reporting change your perspective on immigration activism?
Yeah, so like I said, I do think AIR is pretty effective. My perspective did not change ideologically, but my eyes were open to the different dynamics of discussing immigration rights, just because there are a lot of different facets of conversation. And I really appreciated that there are students who want to make an environment where people can come and talk and really learn about the issues without feeling like they could be criticized or judged. The message of education really resonated with me, and I think that's important when it comes to activism.
Was there anything else you wanted to include in this story but decided to keep out of the final cut?
I would say no. I think most of what AIR's message was definitely included in the piece, and overall the structure of the organization was pretty straightforward, and I believe that their message was accurately conveyed throughout the story.
Ella, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
In campus news, Faculty Senate condemns police violence against last spring's encampment. Proponents argued the demonstration was nonviolent and the police disproportionately harmed students and faculty of color. A resolution passed called the, quote, disproportionate use of law enforcement in a peaceful protest, unquote, a need for shared governance. The Faculty Senate's condemnation joins a list of other campus groups that condemn the police's violence. And in other campus news, 13 UW-Madison students have visas terminated by the U.S. government. The cancellations hit 6 current student visas and 7 alumni visa employment extensions. UW-Madison said it could not determine the exact rationale for the terminations, but the university does not believe they are specific to participation in, quote, free speech events, unquote.
That's all for the Cardinal Call this week. We've been your hosts, Oliver Gerhars
and Ted Hinkstrom. You can find more news and stories from UW-Madison's student journalists at dailycardinal.com.
Now 6:40 p.m. and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. And it's time now for the most comprehensive weather report on the airwaves with WORT weather expert Rob McClure.
Well, if it seemed a bit cold yesterday morning when you were standing at the bus stop, that's because we dropped to 17 degrees, which is as cold as we've been since back on the 2nd of March. And by a few degrees at that, 17 is solidly low, record low temperature territory by this time of year. Though as it happens, we missed the mark yesterday by 8 degrees. On the other hand, we hit 49 today, which was better than I was anticipating. But then there was much about today, actually, that was hard to anticipate. And not just when I gave the forecast about today back on Monday morning, but indeed right up through midday today. This has been one of those situations which we get into occasionally in which the forecast models, even the relatively high-resolution, fast turnaround ones that are working with relatively recent data, still can't quite get a handle on what's happening above us or is about to happen. Part of the issue today is likely due to the rather weak waves that we've had passing basically from northwest to southeast around us across the upper Midwest, and which are likely interacting in ways that the models don't quite have sufficient data to resolve accurately. In any case, a drier air column today, both here and in areas upstream of us to the northwest, have allowed for much less precipitation to develop, in fact, none here in the city, than had generally been depicted on the models, even the drier models, the past couple of days. That appears to be attributable both to the drier air at various levels of the atmosphere above us, but also to less robust lifting and therefore cooling and saturation from the waves that are passing aloft. So we have ended up staying completely dry today in Madison and most areas around around Dane County. Have a look at the water vapor satellite image of the contiguous U.S. that we have linked on the WORT weather webpage this evening, and you'll be able to see the two upper waves that I just mentioned, one streaking southeastward over North Dakota, producing a fair amount of visible leftward spin adjacent to it, and the second to its south, slicing basically in parallel from northwestern Wyoming down across Nebraska towards southern Iowa and central Illinois. That southern system in particular does appear to be inducing enough lift to our southeast this evening to throw down some light showers anyway over southeast Wisconsin. There do now seem to be some returns currently with the radar returns as well, some surface reports, I should say, with the radar returns down in the southeastern counties of Wisconsin, including Walworth and Rock. Otherwise, the primary effect of this current system is likely to simply be the cooling that it produces tomorrow and Friday as Canadian air is swept south behind it. The upper troughing that results from that will re-amplify the upper air pattern across the continent and thus slow down the advance of the upstream ridge, which will be amplifying northward over the coming days to our west in response to low pressure passing across Canada. But the ridge should finally elbow the trough eastward out of the way across the Great Lakes on Saturday, backing Friday's northerly winds, at least nominally southerly. Surface high pressure still looks to have a pretty good grip over us by the time we get to Saturday. So although wind speeds will pick up a little bit by late afternoon that day, I'm not sure we can generate quite enough vertical mixing that we might need to hit 60 degrees, though we should be close, I think, that day. Sunday, we should do better with the thermometer, with warmer air moving in overhead and stronger winds, though encroaching high and mid-level clouds at that time from upstream thunderstorms may again restrain the thermometer just a bit. So, not quite the warm-up we once foresaw for this weekend, up in the low 70s, but a good bit better in any case than the 40s and possibly low 50s that we'll see the next couple of days. We'll cool again then after this weekend's warm-up as we get out into next week with another cycle of rewarming, it looks like, after about Wednesday of next week. But back to tonight, the skies may continue to clear out now from west to east, at least to some extent over the coming couple of hours, but low-level moisture to our east and south may sock us back up with low clouds as we get on towards midnight or into the early hours of tomorrow morning. Temperatures will drop to the mid-30s on easterly winds at 4 to 8 miles per hour. Any showers that are left down in Rock and Walworth County should transit eastward out of there in the next hour or two. Tomorrow, early morning low clouds may be difficult to mix out, but the incoming drier air as the winds back more northeasterly at 5 to 10 miles per hour may lift the deck anyway up in the a higher stratus deck or perhaps broken stratocumulus by afternoon. Cooling of the air column above ground may also lead to some passing light showers as well. Those should be pretty transient, I think, if they occur, sliding fairly quickly north to south. Temperatures will be somewhat cloud-dependent, with some thinning or breaking. We may reach close to 50 degrees, otherwise mid or upper 40s seem likelier. Skies may finally see slightly better clearing as we go overnight as light winds back more northerly, and temperatures will drop to the lower mid-30s by Friday morning. And Friday's kind of a tough call in terms of the sky conditions. Northerly winds will continue at 4 to 8 miles per hour. And I'm expecting that clear skies may again see some cumulus growth diurnally, becoming higher based and perhaps just scattered and cellular through much of the day, but possibly with some wider coverage. Temperatures will hopefully crack 50, possibly up to 53 or 54 if we get a good dose of sun. Clouds should scatter out, cumulus clouds should scatter out by the evening, with temperatures dropping to the low 30s by dawn on Saturday. And Saturday should see winds redeveloping lightly south and come up to 4 to 8 miles per hour by afternoon. We'll shoot for 60 on Saturday anyway. Upper 50s are equally likely. High clouds may become more in evidence by late day, and temperatures will drop to the low and mid-40s overnight with passing high clouds. And Sunday should be another step warmer, with southerly winds coming up to 10 to 15 miles per hour, at least by the afternoon, taking the thermometer to the low and mid-60s, possibly the upper 60s, cross your fingers. Passing high cloud cover that day will have a slight something of a dampening effect on the temperatures. At the moment, at the station down here on Bedford Street, the temperature is 44 degrees. The dew point temperature is 33. Winds are out of the southeast at 12 miles per hour. The lower clouds have moved out, for at least from above the station, leaving patchy, clear skies and otherwise overcast up at about 9,000 feet. And the barometer's at 29.97 inches of mercury and steady over the past couple hours.
It's now 6:48 p.m. and you're listening to the live local news on WORT. We go now to April 1964, when the civil rights movement was in full swing, urban renewal was on the ballot, and the city went easy on teenage smokers. Stu Levitan has the news from 61 years ago this month on tonight's Madison in the 60s.
All these combined. They melt into a dream.
Madison in the 60s, April 1964. It's an active time for the civil rights movement. As the month opens, members of the Congress of Racial Equality are continuing their boycott and picketing of the Sears store on East Washington Avenue, where a maintenance worker is the only black worker among the store's 321 employees. Core Publicity Director Leah Zeldin says many customers have canceled their store charge accounts in support of Core's demand the store hire more black workers, especially in customer-facing positions. Although CORE does not file a formal complaint with the Equal Opportunities Commission, the EOC holds a public hearing under its plenary power to investigate possible discrimination. Testimony is compelling but inconclusive. When the EOC closes its file without action on April 14th, Sears has 3 full-time and 4 part-time black employees. CORE President Silas Norman congratulates the store and urges it to do more. The country's most prominent opponent of the civil rights bill being debated in Congress, Alabama Governor George Wallace, brings his campaign for the Democratic presidential nomination to Madison on the 2nd for an address to the Madison Exchange Club. As about 20 CORE members protest in the cold rain in front of the Cuba Club resident, the staunch segregationist is given a warm reception inside. Wallace tells club members he is not a racist and draws applause for his attack on the pending federal civil rights bill as something that, quote, will destroy the constitutional rights of everybody. And one of the most forceful advocates for the legislation comes to town on the 25th for a rally sponsored by the Madison Committee for Civil Rights. The Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth, a co-founder of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, rouses a Capitol Square crowd of about 500 with his emphatic call for freedom now. UW freshman Tracy Nelson, the young folk blues singer from Shorewood Hills, is among the entertainers. The first demonstration to disrupt the Wisconsin legislature takes place 2 days later, when about 30 college and high school students from the Madison CORE chapter display unauthorized signs in the balcony of the assembly chambers calling for a vote on a fair housing bill. After the assembly sergeant-at-arms brusquely confiscates several signs, the group locks arms and stands to sing "We Shall Overcome" as the annoyed assembly adjourns. There are no arrests as the group marches out singing. CORE chapter leader Silas Norman opposes the action and resigns and leaves about a month later for the Selma Literacy Project. He is succeeded by Bortai Scudder, daughter of British modernist poet Basil Bunting. Earlier this decade, the Madison Redevelopment Authority had brushed off as inconsequential protests by residents of the old Greenbush neighborhood who were angry that their homes and businesses had been seized for the Triangle Urban Renewal Project. But when the MRA started planning the future of property around the university, political opposition became a threat. A group composed largely of small property owners called the Madison Homeowners Association filed almost 8,000 signatures and got a referendum on the April ballot to, quote, terminate all urban renewal activities and abolish the MRA. The entire political establishment, Mayor Henry Reynolds, University President Fred Harvey Harrington, and both newspapers all forcefully opposed the referendum. But on April 7th, the vote comes down to the last precinct reporting. With 36,665 votes cast, representing 70% of registered voters, the MRA survives by only 367 votes, 18,516 to 18,149. The Ninth Ward, home of the controversial Triangle and Brittingham projects, and the Near East Side Sixth Ward, where many are bitterly opposed to an ongoing study of the Marquette neighborhood, both vote heavily to end all renewal activities, while the 14th Ward, where residents favor the South Madison Project, vote heavily to continue. It's strong support from the West Side wards that keeps the MRA alive. But urban renewal itself kills the political careers of 2 East Side incumbent alders, including the 6th Ward Alder who sponsored the MRA's study in his neighborhood. The MRA's public relations consultant later says they should have built low-cost public housing as their first project next to Brittingham Park, rather than the market-rate apartments they approved. A big weekend on campus on April 17th and 18th. While the legendary Bo Diddley rocks the military ball in Great Hall, with Ken Annamani's band The Night Trains on the bill, on Friday night, folk singer Guy Carawan, who first popularized We Shall Overcome, is singing for the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee at the University YMCA. Saturday night, it's a Bo Diddley album and nickel bags of popcorn for the 1,000 who pack Great Hall for the Student Peace Center's 8th Annual Anti-Mill Ball. There's great live music there, too, for the largest turnout yet. Tracy Nelson, sitting in with a Johnny Cal blues band. April 24th is quite a day for Madison Properties Incorporated, the development firm run by broadcast executive Gerald Bartell and developer Robert Brooks. In the morning, they reveal a $12 million project consisting of 26 buildings along a one-mile stretch of University Avenue, with 650 apartments, a 200-room Ramada Inn, plus commercial and office space. A few hours later, they announce plans to build a 10-story, 225-room Holiday Inn in the 400 block of State Street, which would be the second attempt to build a hotel where Victor Music burned down in December 1961. Bartell says he has an accepted offer from Meyer Victor and hopes to begin construction by late July. Ultimately, neither of the two hotels is built, but much of the University Avenue project is. That night, the Common Council sets the city's smoking age at 16. Figuring that smoking and drinking beer should have the same legal age, the council had initially set the smoking age at 18. But after the Madison Youth Council calls this an infringement of personal liberty and urges education rather than enforcement, the council reverses its decision and lowers the legal age by 2 years. Madison Youth Council Vice President Eugene Parks, noting the many aldermen smoking during the meeting, says his group doesn't condone smoking, but, quote, "we feel this is the responsibility of the youth and his parents." Nadine Goff, editor of the Central High School Mirror, tells the council that a survey shows that almost 30% of Central senior high students and nearly 20% of junior high school students smoke or had smoked. And that's this week's Madison in the 60s. For your award-winning, listener-supported, anti-teen smoking WORT news team, I'm Stu Levitan.
And that does it for our show. Thanks for listening to WORT's live local news at 6. Our headline writers this evening were Greg Sanderson and Jack Goodman. Dane Bulow was our reporter, along with Judith Ruiz Branch of the Wisconsin News Connection. Special thanks to feature contributors Oliver Gerhardt, Ted Hingstrom, and Stu Levitan. Katie Giorgella is our on-air engineer on Wednesday evening. Faye Parks produced the newscast, and Shelley Pittman is the news director at WORT. I'm your host, Robert McClure.
And I'm your host, Vicki Iden. Stay up to date with the WORT Local News Podcast. Subscribe on iTunes Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever else you get your podcasts. Up next is Query, followed by This Way Out. Good night.
Support for this program comes from the Konopka Lab at UW-Madison, recruiting adults 55 plus for a clinical trial, testing whether a medication can promote healthy longevity. Details are at 608-228-2978.
WORT thanks its listener sponsors and Five Nines, a locally owned cloud service provider of enterprise-level IT infrastructure consulting, hosting, and management services. On the web at fivenines.com. Phone number 512-1000.
Do you find yourself provoking conversations with your friends and coworkers? Are you a strong listener? Then you should consider applying to become the next host of A Public Affair, WORT's daily hour-long call-in talk program. We're now accepting applications for this volunteer position. The next host will be the voice of Tuesday's show and join a stellar lineup of folks who engage listeners in conversations on social, cultural, and political issues of importance every day of the week. We're looking for someone who is curious and well-informed, comfortable speaking on air, someone who can think on their feet, and has at least 5 hours a week to prepare and host the show. To find out more information or apply, go to wortfm.org/talkhost.
W-O-R-T, W-O-R-T, Madison, 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 W-O-R-T,
Madison, 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 Madison,
W-O-R-T, Madison, 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 W-O-R-T,
Madison, 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 Madison,
W-O-R-T, Madison, 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 W-O-R-T.
We were never professional journalists. We were all social scientists who gained this experience by working and becoming the journalists. I think we